Good morning. This is Nancy Williams in for Petals and Prose. And today I'd like to read you from another essay from one of my favorite authors, from one of my favorite books. This is from Sue Hubble's book, A Country Year. Sue Hubble, you may remember from the past, is a 50-year-old ex-librarian and a beekeeper and a self-taught naturalist who lives by herself in the Missouri Ozarks and writes about them. So when I read about honey, I'm usually reading from her book, too. This is just about spring, and I'm kind of antsy for spring right now. You probably are, too. So she just begins her spring section with this essay. The river to the north of my place is claimed by the U.S. Park Service, and the creek to the south is under the protection of the Missouri State Conservation Department. So I am surrounded by government land. The deed to the property says my farm is 105 acres, but it's probably something more like 90. The land hasn't been surveyed since the mid-1800s, and it's hard to know where the boundaries are. A park ranger told me he suspected that the 19th century surveyor had run his lines from a tavern because the corners seem to have been established by someone in his cups. The place is so beautiful that it nearly brought tears to my eyes the first time I saw it 12 years ago. I feel the same way today, so I have never much cared about the number of acres or where the boundary lines run or who exactly owns what. But the things that make it so beautiful and desirable to me have also convinced others that this is prime land, too, and belongs to them as well. At the moment, for instance, I am feeling a bit of an outsider, having discovered that I live in the middle of an indigo bunting ghetto. As ghettos go, it is a cheerful one in which to live, but it has forced me to think about property rights. Indigo buntings are small but emphatic birds. They believe that they own the place, and it's hard to ignore their claim. The male birds, brilliant, shimmering blue, perch on the garden posts or on top of the cedar trees that have taken over the pasture. From there, they survey their holdings and belt out their songs, complicated tangles of couplets that waken me first thing in the morning. They keep it up all day, even at noon, after the other birds have quieted. The indigo buntings have several important facts to tell us, especially about who's in charge around here. The dull brown sparrow-like females and juveniles are more interested in eating. They stay nearer the ground and search the low-growing shrubs and grasses for seeds and an occasional caterpillar, but even they know what's what. One day, walking back along the edge of the field, I came upon a young indigo bunting, preoccupied with song practice. He had not yet dared take as visible a perch as his father would have chosen, but there he was, clinging to a bare twig and softly running through his couplets, getting them all wrong and then going back over them so quietly that if I had not been within a few feet of him, I would not have heard. Another time I discovered that the back door of the honey house had blown open and the room was filled with a variety of winged creatures. Most were insects, but among them I found a half-grown indigo bunting who had blundered in and was trying to find his way out, beating his small wings against the screened window. Holding him carefully, I stroked the back of his neck to try to soothe him, but discovered that his heart was not beating in terror. Perhaps he was so young that he had not learned fear, but I prefer to think that, like the rest of his breed, he was simply too pert and too sure of his rights to be afraid. He eyed me crossly and tweaked my giant thumb with his beak to tell me that I was to let him go right this minute. I did so, of course, and I watched him fly off to all the tall grasses behind the honey house, where I knew that one family of indigo buntings had been nesting. Well, they think they own the place, and their assurance is only countered by a scrap of paper in my files. But there are other contenders, and perhaps I ought to try to take a census and judge claims before I grant them title. There are other birds who call this place theirs. Buzzards, who work the updrafts over the river and creek. Goldfinches, wild turkeys, phoebes, and whippoorwills. But it's a pair of cardinals who have ended up with the prize piece of real estate, the spot with the bird feeder. I have tapes of bird songs, and when I play them, I try to skip the one of the cardinal, because the current resident goes into a frenzy of territorial song when he hears his rival. His otherwise lovely day is ruined. And what about the coyote? For a while, she was confident that this was her farm, especially the chicken part of it. She was so sure of herself that once she sauntered by in daylight and picked up the tough old rooster to take back to her pups. However, the dogs grew wise to her, and the next few times she returned to exercise her rights, they chased her off, explaining that this farm belonged to them and that the chicken flock was their responsibility. When I started thinking about it that way, that those who inhabit the land and use it have a real claim to it as in a non-legal sort of a way, the whole question gets complicated. A long time ago, before I came to live in the Ozarks, I spent a springtime working on a plot of university research land. I was young and in love, and most tasks seemed happy ones, but the project would have captured my fancy anyway. There were three contrasting habitats being studied: upland forest, bottomland, and sandy waste. My job was to dig up a cube of earth from each place every week, sift it, count, and rough classify the inhabitants visible to the naked eye, and then plot the population growth. The resulting curve, a joyous, vibrant freshening of life, matched the weather and my own pulse beat. That particular love has quieted, and I have not excavated cubes of earth on this place, but I know what is going on down there. Millions of little bodies are fiercely metabolizing and using the land. I dare not even think what numbers I would come up with if I added a pocket lens or microscope to my census-taking tools. But there are other residents I can count who do have arguable title here. There are 20 hives of bees back by the woodlot in my home bee yard, each hive containing some 60,000 bees. That makes 1,200,000 bees, their souls flitting about making claim to all the flowers within 2 miles. On the other hand, there are the copperheads, who make walking the fields a boot affair, and all of their snakish kin. How am I to count them and judge their claims? There are the turtles, who eat the strawberries in the garden, the peepers who own the pond. What about raccoon and skunk and deer rights? What about the bobcat, who denned in the cliff by the river and considers my place to be the nearest, merest sliver of her own? It begins to make me dizzy, even trying to think of taking a census of everybody who lives here, and all of them seem to have certain claims to the place that are every bit as good, and perhaps better, than mine. Up the road there's a human squabble going over some land less happily situated. Rather than lying between two environmentally benign government stakeholders, that land and all that surrounds it is in private land. One owner wants to bulldoze and develop, and so the boundary question is becoming a sticky one. There is talk about having an expensive survey made to establish who owns what. As a spin-off, I suppose that corners will be set and lines will be run, and then I may know whether this farm is 105 acres or 90 or some other definity. The indigo buntings probably won't care. And that is Sue Hubbell's Country Year, and I am Nancy Williams. See you next time.